Hello.
How are you?
You ever like walk through a cobweb or something that feels like a cobweb, and then suddenly you're like, oh God, do I have a spider on me? And you start freaking out about it for like 5 minutes.
As a matter of fact, that happened an hour ago. I was parking my car in the carport, and I walked around back to get something out of the trunk. And as I walked back around the other side of the car, I walked through a cobweb. But what's interesting is technically the car should have driven through the cobweb, so there shouldn't have been a cobweb there, except if there was like a hanging shred of a cobweb from the car tearing through it, in which case that's also discomforting because that's one strong web.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So I'm probably going to die is the moral of the story. I just don't see the spider that's going to kill me.
It's going to crawl up and bite you in the neck while we're talking or something.
Yeah. All of a sudden, I'll pass out. I'll asphyxiate. I'll not be able to breathe. No, but so I take it from this line of questioning that that happened to you as well, and it wasn't just like a random thought experiment.
Yeah, kind of. I have that except for scorpions because I took the dog out just before we did this, and Amanda decided she wanted to go scorpion hunting because she hasn't done that in a while. So she got the little UV flashlight out and was back there by the pool pump where they all like to hang out because it's moist and shaded and cool. And she found two very large ones, but in order to spray them to death with the bug killer, I was basically like standing in a palm tree with like resting on my head and then like on my shoulder. So then I'm like, I feel palm fronds rustling, and it feels like things are crawling on me as I'm trying to spray these giant scorpions to death. So, you know,
Ah,
same.
yes, exactly the same.
It's scorpion season because of the temperature change. They start coming out, hanging out on the sidewalks, looking for a cool place to rest their disgusting bellies.
Ugh. Well, that's a comforting thought. I
The
don't
they're unstoppable killing machines is what I'm saying.
much like the machines featured in this movie. And by this movie, I mean the month of May. So we are doing James Cameron. We've got a.
I told Amanda that was what we were doing, she asked if she could divorce both of us.
Oh, well, I mean, we'd have to get married before the divorce, and then that would be polygamy? I don't know. Anyway, bigamy? Wait, which one is it? It's big. I don't know. Anyway, I'm not a
It's like a
lawyer.
mutual agreement, so it's not like one of us has two spouses. It's like it's just all of us do, so.
Yes, so she can't is what I'm saying. Sorry, Amanda. You're stuck with James Cameron. But the reason why I thought of him recently is because he was in the news doing some press for the Avatar being like Godfather
Was he
because of the
doing
family
press,
epic.
or was he just like trying to stir up some
He
stuff?
was doing an interview. I mean, he's not out on like a press junket for the movie. It's not he's still making the movies. He's making Avatar 2 and 3 back to back at the same time, and then they don't have the green light to go forwards with 4 and 5, but he has assured everyone that it's fully scripted out and there's stuff there to immediately go into production when the green light hits, which is I guess a warning shot to us as the audience.
It's going to immediately go into production 9 years later.
Yeah, no, I he's a very interesting person. One of the interesting things about James Cameron is his humble beginnings as a visual effects guy for Roger Corman movies and working on B movies and starting to move into directing and working on things like Piranha 2. So that's he had a slow start. I think a lot of people think about his career now and they don't realize that he did a lot of Drek went at the start of his career to get to where he is today. And one of those somewhat Drekky things is actually The Terminator, which is kind of a low budget B movie kind of a thing. It is more like his early career than obviously anything that you think of when you think of James Cameron nowadays. Even Aliens is a dramatically different movie from this, and Aliens is just like right after The Terminator. So it is a whole different ball game when you look at it.
Yeah, this movie suffers from a lot of things, and I wonder, I mean, I'm sure we can break it down piece by piece, but it really does feel like a very low budget indie sci-fi kind of movie. In the same way, what were we talking about? Are we talking about it with Back to the Future with Seth, where it's if you watch a scene, you really see it's just like shot, cut to shot, cut to shot to assemble a movie out of just like individual pieces when Seth did his little David Mamet quote or whatever. But like the individual pieces of this movie are all just like very simple, basic things and assembled in a way that turn it into a movie. And you're like watching these building blocks of like indie film in front of you. They're not like, there's a couple of big things that occur, but for the most part, it's not like big set pieces in this movie. It's just, it's a very small, weird movie. And it's very, very, very 80s. It suffers very badly from, well, you know, some of the effects, lack of budget stuff, but also just like, my God, the score in this.
And the hair. The hair.
And the hair, yes. the choice to do the blow-up thing where Schwarzenegger lost his eyebrows and then, like, singed his hair and turned it into, like, a wig, like, I don't know what motivated that choice other than, like, oh, I want to make the hair look extra bad.
Well, I'll tell you what motivated that choice. They could not get close to realistic with the puppet, so you better make your person look more like the puppet.
So they dumped down the actual hair to make it look like the puppet hair?
That is my theory. I have not seen a confirmation of this, but I am assuming that it is much easier to match wigs than it is to try to put all the hair follicles into the puppet to look exactly the same.
Mm.
Even though the puppet, even with matching wig stuff, does and missing eyebrows, still looks quite different from Arnold Schwarzenegger.
They tried to give him like the pasty, like the clammy looking skin, the pale skin when it starts to die-ish, sort of.
Yeah, well, there's a certain point of the movie where his organic components are basically rotting off of him because of the damage that he's sustained. And he's there's like a janitor that walks by the apartment that he's in. It's like, you got a dead cat in there, buddy. That's because he smells bad, and we as the audience are not treated to that experience, so we just have to go off of that dialogue to communicate that to us.
Yeah, it's interesting that like they're trying to convey some of these themes. You know, they're the expository descriptive sections where, you know, he's trying to explain what's going on to Sarah when he's being interviewed by the stupid cop shrink guy, where he, you know, he's describing how the Terminators work and that sort of stuff. But then, you know, the ones where you try to see it, like clearly he's going to field fix himself with an X-Acto knife and some, I don't know, gauze or whatever. But also this idea that, you know, the living flesh that is bred to go over top of these robots also, when is damaged, will begin to decay. Although apparently it decays pretty quickly with, not minor damage because he lost an eye or whatever, but
I mean, he was riddled with shotgun shots, so his skin is not like a tightly sealed envelope at that point.
Right, but I don't think that would really accelerate his decomposition to the point where you'd be smelling it through a door, but I don't know.
Well, I think it probably would have been more apparent to us had there been other signs of that visually. Like, you look at Men in Black Edgar? Edgar's like dissolving, basically, and you're seeing more and more of the bugginess and the decaying skin that's hanging off. You don't get anything like that here. He basically looks Arnold Schwarzenegger-ish the entire time, just with like some bloody bits, and the blood doesn't seem to like coagulate or scab or anything. It just is red and glistening, which does not lend a lot to the realism of that particular effect, because it's not like he was just shot. He was like shot hours ago, so it sort of looks weird. It's like a, it's like you were doing like a carnival and every person coming through the ride had to see like the guy, like, you know, be shot up or break or something, and so they had to make it look like it was freshly done every single time. So that's what that looks like. Is like, it looks like a fresh wound, rather than like the hours that have passed in between that they try to pretend has occurred.
Mm. Mm-hmm. See, but if I'm Skynet and I'm trying to design a robot that looks as human as possible, I would probably make something that, sure, it looks like flesh, feels like flesh, and sweats and smells and all that stuff like Reese described, but I would make one that didn't, like, decompose or whatever, like, that always looked, like, chill and cool no matter what, because if it starts to, like, decompose, it's not going to be able to blend in, because there aren't a lot of decomposing humans walking around, even though that's what normal flesh would do. You would kind of want, like, the anti-decomposing flesh, just so you can, like, fit in after having been damaged or something.
Dan, this is science, obviously. You can't
just have
magically not decomposing flesh. This is all real stuff that you see in this film. So there's no way to do that.
I'm just saying Skynet went a little bit too far on the realism and kind of they were not aiming toward their goal. They were aiming for realism, and real isn't always good.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's one of the main drawbacks of this film is how realistic it tries to be. We've already started nitpicking it, but it is
a little bit of nitpicking, and suddenly it's decomposing.
Yeah, who would have thought? It smells like a dead cat in here. But the movie itself, like we said, is low budget, and it is very B movie, and it is while it has James Cameron and his attitudes and his ideas in here, there's a lot of, like, I don't know, Ed Wood going on. there's like, we got the shot, go, like, go to the next scene.
There's not a lot of coverage, is there? And the coverage there is, it's a lot of, like, really tight angles, so you don't want to, like, give anything away.
No, I mean, they had a budget of $6.4 million. $6.4 million to make this whole thing. Casting, effects, stop motion stuff, puppets, makeup, everything, location shoots, the whole thing, sets that needed to be built for, like, the police precinct and stuff like that. It all had to be done for $6.4 million, which is hilarious to me because I can't imagine anybody proposing to James Cameron that he make a movie for $6.4 million these days.
Multiply by 100, maybe.
Yeah. Also, James Cameron sold the rights to make the movie to Gale Ann Hurd for $1 on the condition that he would direct the film.
Oh, is that how we got the directing gig?
Yes. She had also worked for Corman too, so they had a prior relationship, and then of course they went on to be married for a bit. Before then, he also went on to marry the star of this picture, but that was later. James Cameron's love life is not... It's a different topic than we're going to cover on this show. But she apparently had some feedback, but did not participate in writing. But she was a producer on it, and that's how he got to do this. But they had to secure financing through another means, and that was this Hemdale company that came through with the financing for it, and they had very little, as we have discussed, and they wanted a star, so they were pitching, they were trying to push for Schwarzenegger to be Kyle Reese, and that turned into Schwarzenegger being the Terminator, and knowing their intentions now, it would have been comically hilarious to witness Arnold Schwarzenegger as Kyle Reese in this, and not just because his acting sort of improved later in his career than this current time, but also just because he just, like, the physicality of him would seem inappropriate for the particulars of Kyle Reese. We have Michael Biehn as Kyle Reese, who we will see again sort of when he does Aliens. We've covered Aliens previously on the show. They had a good working relationship. Lance Henriksen, also good working relationship. You see him in the police office, but he was a friend of Cameron's who did the Terminator impression when he was doing his initial pitch.
I could see him doing a very good robot.
Yes. Yes, I think many people could see Lance Henriksen being a good robot. But he was literally a good robot. But he obviously did not do that. James Cameron was going to throw the whole thing out the window by sort of sabotaging his meeting with Schwarzenegger before he realized that he wanted him as the Terminator and not as Kyle Reese, and then trying to convince the studio to do that. Which is just fascinating now, knowing the directions that their careers would go in and the times that we would work together after this.
Knowing what we know about James Cameron, he seems like he would have had the sequel in mind from the beginning, like from the very, very get-go. He probably had something in mind for the next one, so you would have imagined he would have had the forethought to be okay with, you know, not having Schwarzenegger be Kyle Reese because he's going to die, and everyone else could be okay with that, and then Schwarzenegger could go on to be the silent robot man and as many as he wants, because it doesn't matter if he doesn't talk.
Well, I haven't found anything that really suggests what James Cameron was thinking in terms of sequels at this stage. Apparently, in the development process, he had two Terminators travel back in time, very similar to what he would go on to do in Terminator 2. And one of them was an Arnold Schwarzenegger kind of Terminator, and the other one was a liquid metal Terminator. And then he realized that they wouldn't be able to make that. So
he wrote two first and then scaled it back for one?
Yeah, and had the other one be a human. So the liquid metal would go on to be something that you see in Terminator 2, but that I don't think was an intentional sequel idea at the time. That was just his constraints on the production that he was doing.
And maybe it just worked so well the first time when he did this movie and then the sequel that just became his thing forever.
Yeah, well, I mean, the sequel is, what is it, 6 years after this? I don't think he was in a rush for that necessarily.
It's hard to watch this movie after knowing the sequel exists, even.
Oh, I know. I assume this might be the same for you, but I grew up in an era where you would see Terminator 2 Judgment Day sometimes on TV. Of course, a heavily edited version, or the special editions and blah, 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 when they started doing DVD releases. And so I had more exposure to Terminator 2 Judgment Day than I had exposure to The Terminator. And so when you watch that first, before you watch The Terminator, you're just, I don't want to say spoiled, but
you're spoiled because everything about it is better. The story's better, the acting's better, the movie making is better.
Yeah, well, but also, I mean, there are actors who carry over from this one to the next one, and you see a significant improvement in the performances that they deliver in the second one. Notably, I would say Linda Hamilton. She has moments where she does a good job in this film, but then she has other things where it seems like she just read the script before she had to do the acting on the set.
Which may well have been the case if there were changes as happened during production. But I think a lot of that's probably just because they're like, all right, we got enough film to get one angle on this, so give me your best. Like, we're not going to be able to pick this up in coverage because we just can't afford it. So go.
We spent all our money on the iguana. But
why is the iguana in this movie? Just to like give her a jump scare before she gets murdered.
I have no idea. It is an interesting quirk, but that I assume was intended to add flavor to her character, but it does nothing. But that's fine. It's not central to anything. What I find more interesting is her roommate Ginger and their job at what is it, Big Jeff's?
Was it her roommate that was also the one at the place, or
I thought they worked together and were roommates?
All I know is that her waitress pal from work is a very bad actor.
Yes, well, I have some news for you about Ginger. she's also not terrific, but I would say nobody is really delivering a stellar performance here. Even a fantastic actor like Lance Henriksen or Paul Winfield, they just don't have apparently the time or rehearsal or direction to pull off what you know they can pull off in other roles. So it's sort of interesting to see that as well.
Which is weird, though, because for a movie like this, it's not a movie like Star Wars where you got a bunch of skeptical actors going, what the hell is this movie going to be about? You want me to say what words? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, the entire premise of this movie is, I'm going to say some ridiculous crap, and you're supposed to be super skeptical and live in the moment and say, like, that's not time travel and robots aren't a real thing, and be believable, which should be kind of like your default mode, right?
Yeah, I mean... It's just, there are some really clunky things that they have to work with and try to make believable. And the police interrogation scenes in particular, where they're supposed to be answering questions that the audience has, that is not as organic as it could be in the process in this film. Also, there are some scenes between Lance Henriksen and Paul Winfield when they're like, oh, man, we're really stumped on who's doing the serial killing. that is not organic either. Like, there's a whole, like, cigarette gag of, like, let me hear cigarettes. Oh, I already have one lit and I forgot about it at the beginning of the scene. Like that.
At least they start off kind of normal, like, sassing each other, like, I have eyes, my glasses do work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I like Paul Winfield as an actor. He does a good job. And of course, you know. He was in Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, and he was also.
I saw that. I don't remember who he was though.
He was the captain. He was the captain of the Reliant who got brain slugged, and then he shot himself rather than kill Captain Kirk.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we could do three hours on it right now if you want.
No,
I'm ready. Let's go
on brain slugging.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine.
Yeah, but he was also in Star Trek The Next Generation as Captain Dathan in an episode called Darmok, where you have seen many internet memes spawned from, you know.
Have I?
Yeah, you have. You don't know you have, but you have. You've seen
Are
it.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Okay.
Take my word for it. Shaka, when the walls fell. But this, and of course, Lance Henriksen is also a good actor. So watching the two of them in scenes together where it seems like they have just walked onto a set 10 minutes ago and were handed papers and told to do it is a little sad because I think they could have done a much better job had they had the time and the direction. But
yeah,
you know, what are you gonna do?
It makes you wonder where the stumbling blocks were. Like, I kind of want to know how many days it took them to shoot this movie too, because maybe that was another thing. Just, you know, a consequence of the low budget, they just had to move really fast and didn't have the time to spend on the performances. Because these are all people who went on to work with James Cameron more and are much better in other things. But
yeah, and you know, particularly like we were saying with Linda Hamilton, you look at her performance in. Terminator 2, she is like transformed into the role of Sarah Connor, like the rebel leader. And then you look at her performance here, and it is I would say almost like a TV movie kind of level, like everyday girl person, as written in the 80s. Mostly, I would say, because of the writing, but
It's probably hard, yeah. It's probably kind of exhausting to just be like scared and vulnerable for like 20 days straight or whatever it is she had to do on set. So it's just like at some point it's easier to sort of get in the maybe she's just more like prone to dig it into the tough guy mentality kind of thing.
Well, her the best moments for her come when Kyle Reese has been injured at the end of the film, and she has to have take on all of the problems that are coming at her, which is a challenge that she hasn't had to face until that point of the film, because basically every time the Terminators come around, she has evaded it because of Kyle helping, basically dragging her from scene to scene. She's had to be scared and frightened and stuff the whole entire time. And in these final moments in the whatever manufacturing plant, she is able to figure out how to dispose of this Terminator torso all by herself. And she's pretty clever about it when given the means and the time to do it. And you can really see that she's giving the performance her all, even though she's just acting against a puppet. And that's why part of the reason why I think the writing earlier in the film, because her character is not given much to do in the scenes. Like in the scene where Kyle takes her from the Technoir club and puts her into the car, and then he's like being a total butthole to her, and and just telling her not to move and not to whatever, and you're gonna do what I say, that whole thing. And she's just like supposed to be catatonic, but then like all of a sudden snaps out of it, but then she's scared and then wants to get out of the car, and then she's catatonic again. It's just like, it's a lot to put on her to just sort of occupy space in a scene without having things to do. So I think that was kind of a bummer.
And on the fourth day where James Cameron goes like, all right, you don't know this guy. He's demanding you like follow him, and he's being real weird, not explaining anything, and you're freaked out. She's like, yeah, I get it. I'll try.
I'm already freaked out. Stop yelling
at
me, James.
Thanks for clarifying what my role in the scene was. I had no idea.
Yeah. Doesn't everybody call him Jim anyway? Anyway, so
I call him Jimmy. Me and Jimmy.
I call him Jimbo. I'm a big fan of the Jimbo. Yeah. So anyway, I don't necessarily blame any of these actors or actresses for the performances that are delivered here. I think they did not have the tools afforded to them. Because you can see in Terminator 2 when. Like even the criminal psychologist, Dr. Silberman, he shows up here and he is as banal and uninteresting as you could imagine him to be.
He's like, a fat, lazy dummy.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's not use pejoratives against our movie criminal psychologist, Stan.
The stereotype that they're building for him. Yes, like he's yawning and chewing on a pen and he's just there to like poke fun at the guy. Like he's not there to do anything other than just like, you know, be silly guy who doesn't take his job seriously in the scene.
Yeah, but then you compare that to his performance in Terminator 2 and you're just like, okay, so this guy can act and he's incredibly memorable and you know, you
right,
just got
he's lazy and misguided, but he's like he's evil unintentionally because he doesn't believe her. Like he's playing a real character, not just like, oh, look at me, I'm small town cop psychologist guy.
Yeah, so, I mean, he is a character and is able to fulfill that in the later film. So I just think, again, tracing this mostly back to James Cameron's inexperience, low budget, and lack of time, it affects, like, every aspect of what you see on the screen. That's why we need to support the arts, is really the moral of the story.
If this movie would have had a $60 million budget, boy, would it have been a different story going forward.
Well, I mean, that would have been interesting. What was the budget of Aliens? I feel like it was also kind of low-ish.
I think it was like around or under 20. Or did I just make that up?
I'm scrolling.
18.5 is what IMDb says.
Yep, 18.
So the thing about this movie that I'm curious about, what your opinion, because you probably know more about the history of sci-fi type things than I do. What is it that like made this movie interesting or inspiring enough to even warrant a sequel? Because like, oh yeah, it was cool, it was a good movie, whatever, it made some money back, but it wasn't like, it didn't shock the world, I think, necessarily in the way where Terminator 2 kind of did. But it's just, in my eyes, it's just that, like, I don't know, I can't think of a sci-fi time travel-y movie that predates this that kind of had as iconic a story. But I mean, sure, everything's based off everything. But what is it that you think made this one like stick and warrant a sequel?
Well, I mean, this one is sort of, according to some people, based on something. But
this is not the better movie. So you wouldn't see this and go like, oh, I, you know, not everyone would see this movie and go, I see the potential of this as a thing. Or, I mean, they weren't thinking franchise as much as we are now, but I'm sure they weren't like, we can do stuff with this that wasn't done. I think a lot of people saw it and were just like, well, that was cool, but like, whatever. It's fine. It's gone. It's done.
Yeah, well, I mean, there were, according to Wikipedia, because I was not reading the trades back in the late 80s.
You didn't have a subscription to Variety in the 80s?
Yeah, I'd just be like Boss Baby, just sitting there with a subscription to Variety at my high top table. But
that's exactly how I picture you, hanging out in Florida underneath a palm tree, reading Variety in a high top table.
Yep, as you do. There were a lot of problems because Hemdel had issues and there was Carlico Pictures somehow involved and like the whole big blob of garbage that just kept things from getting going. And also the technical things of James Cameron wanting to do like basically that T-1000 idea that he had for Liquid Metal. And he used sort of the Abyss as a proof of concept for the technical problems that would come from that. And that, of course, the water pseudopod sequence that you see inside of the Abyss. That was basically like, hey, we can do some sort of liquid thing with computer graphics. That was, you know, important to, I would say, Terminator 2. Like, could you imagine Terminator 2 if it had gone into production, like, in 1986 or something like that?
That would have been so bad, because,
You would have silver clay moving around into balls and turning into people.
There would probably be a lot of like tobacco-y looking sunsets still, and maybe some light shafts coming through windows and stuff. But yeah, this would not have been a great movie 2 years after this. I don't know. I don't want to validate James Cameron's insanity and say like he had to wait till the technology was available to make the thing, right?
But
it really is just kind of like the appropriate time and place for making that movie. Like Terminator 2 works on so many levels because of when it was made, where this one seems to suffer from when it was made. But I don't know.
But I would put forth that you need to have a movie like this for Terminator 2 to come out, because you need to be able to prove that this director can handle doing certain things. And as we have discussed,
did this movie prove that?
It proved that you could still give this guy money and that he would have interesting ideas and be able to turn those interesting ideas into a movie that would be profitable. That's what this movie proved. Because again, $6.4 million, box office of $78.3 million. So that's not chump change. But it is definitely something where you could not start with Terminator 2. Unless James Cameron had done something like this first. It just hadn't been this. And then gone on to be like, I have an idea for this Terminator franchise that'll just be totally different.
Yeah. And I guess the stakes were lower, mid-80s, early 90s, in terms of studios. Like, they were more willing to take some risks. So going from a $6 million movie to a $100 million sequel may not have seemed as ludicrous back then, I guess. Well, that's kind of what they do now, too, since there's nothing being made in between those two numbers. It would just go from like a $9 million initial movie to a $250 million sequel that would be terrible. But
nowadays, what you do is you take a proven franchise that has already had a director at the helm, and then you hand it to somebody who is not a proven director. Because they make less money and will charge less, and then you tell them to do the same thing to not make it too different from what the people who cost more did. And that's how you do modern movie making.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so I think as my brain is like processing these things here, here's what I think I'm trying to say with my cynical take on Terminator 1. What about this movie do you watch, and with an eye towards the directorial role specifically, makes you go, I like what that guy did there, I'm going to give him another one, rather than just like, that was a really cool story, or, you know, the ideas behind it are really interesting and he wrote it or whatever. Sure, let him write the sequel. But what about this movie did you see and go like, I really like his eye and his taste as a director, I'm going to give him more movies to direct? Or is it just that he was able to negotiate his way into the director's seat because he wrote it and it was successful and that sort of stuff?
Well, I as comical as this will sound to you, I will say that it is his ability to handle the technical aspects of the visual effects and special effects side of things. Mm. And I know,
so you're going back to like the Back to the Future, like planning for effects thing.
I mean, he's obviously his previous job was planning for this kind of stuff. He's obviously capable of pulling that off. I believe that if you gave the same amount of money to somebody else who did not have James Cameron's background, that you would have even worse looking effects than you have in this film.
Sure.
Yeah.
I agree with all that stuff there, but going forward from this.
Yeah. That was point one, Your Honor.
Okay.
Point
all one. Right, go ahead.
All right.
Continue.
thank you, Your Honor. So the other thing is that while it seems rushed and the performances are not amazing, he is able to target action beats that he wants to get, and he gets those action beats. So there's a chase. He films a very competently executed chase. There's another chase. Does the same thing again. Now, there's nothing about it that is notable in that, oh my god, he's changed police chases forever. But it is something that would give you confidence if you were looking for a director for something that he can pull that off. Because I've witnessed a lot of movies where you give a director an action scene to do, and all of a sudden it turns into a bunch of like broken lines of action, and like they don't know where to put cameras or get coverage for anything, and you totally lose the geography of the scene you're in. And while they hopscotch all over the Los Angeles area when they're filming this, you still get the sense of the geography of the scene and what the stakes are in every one of these action scenes that they have. And the components of what is at stake and how they will get out of a situation and what the peril is specifically are all very well communicated on screen. So it's not again changing the genre, but it is that sort of blending of action and effects and science fiction, and being able to execute what is, according to some, a unique idea. According to someone else, deserving of acknowledgement credit and a $65,000 settlement. But
yeah, so can you explain that credit to me?
Okay, so Harlan Ellison is notoriously litigious. And I say that because he has sued a lot of people. And
please don't sue us, Harlan Ellison.
Yeah, the main Incomparable show, of which we are on the Incomparable Network, recently did a sort of best of Harlan Ellison episode. I will put that in the show notes. I believe you should check that out, listeners, if you want to find out more about his weirdness. But he has a lot of ideas. He's an idea guy, and he writes a lot of short stories. And so he doesn't have to detail a lot of things that he writes in short stories. He can just sort of write broad strokes. And that leaves him in a position where if anybody else has a similar idea or has ever potentially read something that he read and had an idea based very incredibly loosely off of some idea that he had, then he feels that he can spot that and sue them into oblivion. He's just charming, but it is the situation.
So he's a patent troll for movies, basically.
Basically, Harlan Ellison is a patent troll for movies. Yes, but he is. Sometimes it's warranted. In this particular case, I would say, in my position as a lawyer who was just arguing for something, but now I'm going to promote myself to judge. As the judge of this case, I am saying that Harlan Ellison does not have a claim here, because the episode that it's based on, that he says it's based on, is an Outer Limits episode called Soldier, which is based on a short story that he had originally written before that about two soldiers in a future battle on Earth who get hit by some energy spike and are sent back in time. One of them materializing before the other one materializes. They're just humans in a war. And that the one guy protects some family that he has befriended, and the other guy is going to blow everything up and kill everybody. And so he's got to defend that. So not a one-to-one relationship at all. But it was enough that Harlan Ellison was going to sue them because he felt like the beginning of the movie with somebody materializing out of a time vortex or whatever was something that he owned the rights to. So he threatened the lawsuit, and they settled with the credit being given, and James Cameron not being a party to that decision. It was just something between the production company. And so he was unhappy. He's still unhappy, and he's been legally advised not to talk about how unhappy he is.
Mm.
But Harlan Ellison likes to sue people. Is basically the long form of that. Also, a lot of people like to sue James Cameron, which is entertaining. You can find several articles on the internet, especially with Avatar, where a lot of people feel like Avatar is directly ripped from just their particular work, which well, is funny.
it's ripped from a lot of things, but I don't think any particular thing.
No, which is one of the interesting things about James Cameron's ability to take a bunch of different ideas and synthesize something incredibly generic out of it.
The ability to take something... an incredibly simple, basic, pseudo-generic story and then put some sort of stamp or branding or spin on it to make it his.
Yeah, I mean, this, like I said, doesn't really directly relate to Harlan Ellison, but obviously, you know, James Cameron grew up and he saw the Outer Limits episode and he's been exposed to Harlan Ellison's work, so... In some way, those ideas shaped the ideas that he would go on to have, but that is not what made Terminator. Like, Terminator is not a retelling of Harlan Ellison's work, but good for James Cameron that he's not directly ripping off anybody. And I feel like there's a very postmodern kind of sensibility of, like, you know, having ideas that are based on the ideas that have come before you, and being able to build on that. And so he does with time traveling, soldiers, only one of them is a machine. And it's all about this time paradox of killing, the person you were sent back in time to kill. And again, the paradox thing, let's not really address the stupid time paradox.
The part about him being sent back by his son.
Yeah, he was sent back by his son, and Reese impregnates Sarah Connor and saves her life from the machine, who is going to kill her. But if the machine had successfully killed her, the machine would not have been sent back in time. Now, they try to skirt around that issue by having Kyle Reese deliver some lines about a possible future being the one that they're going to, meaning that...
he's not a tech guy, Joe.
Yeah. It's just... Kyle Reese. It's kind of like a... Well, I would say that Looper takes some cues from Terminator in some ways. spoiler for Looper paradoxes, but
spoiler for every Terminator movie after number two.
Yeah, spoiler for any time travel movie, basically. Time travel is almost always like not well executed, and it usually involves somebody from the future going back to stop or undo something that someone in the past did. And
anytime somebody gets a little too bold and decides that they want to explore the rules of the time travel in their particular world, then it gets very messy. If you kind of gloss over them as best you can and just like use that to tell a story, you're usually better off.
Yeah. And for the most part, they try to gloss over it here by having you move from scene to scene and having the barest of explanations about stuff. But there are explanations, and if you do write them down and try to actually like think about how any of them make sense, then the answer is they don't.
Really, the least messy one is the one where they destroy the Terminator and Kyle Reese hooks up with Sarah. Like that's the one that is the least broken in terms of paradox stuff, because then John Connor can be born and send him back.
Yeah, but. My question, I mean, the paradox thing is really like a hypothetical of like, if the Terminator had succeeded, how would Skynet have done this to kill her?
It wouldn't.
Yeah. So that's the paradox. But they try to get around it by saying a possible future, meaning that if it had come back and killed her, then one of the future outcomes was that she wouldn't have been there and that the robot, but then that doesn't make any sense because how would the robot be a possible future at that point? Anyway, so it's one of those things that's best not to think too hard about because again, it's a robot from the future going back to kill somebody. But it is, mainly just sort of a sci-fi spectacle rather than like a deep thought experiment about like, you know, like what happens if you, like a hypothetical that is often posed is what if you went traveled back in time and killed a certain prominent figure in history, then how would history be shaped if they hadn't existed? And that's a fun thought experiment to have, and you can do that on your free time, but we're not here for that.
I guess another way they get around it is by Kyle saying that it's a one-way trip because they destroyed the machine or whatever. Also, I guess the machine doesn't exist in the past, so they can't go forward. Like, they don't have a DeLorean with them to take them back to whatever time period they want to go to, forward, backward, or whatever. They're just there now, so, like, for all intents and purposes, they are in 1984. One of them just happens to be an advanced robot, and one of them is a guy that knows a bunch of stuff. So, at that point, you're kind of like, it doesn't matter what the time travel is a real thing.
Yeah, and the explanation for why they were naked at the beginning of the movie is in the scene with Dr. Silverman, where he says that only organic stuff can travel back in time. And the doctor's like, well, the robot is not organic, so how'd that happen? He's like, oh, it's a cyborg. It's covered in... organic material, which allows it to travel through time, which I guess, okay, fine, whatever. But then if that's the case, why don't you just have like a meat sleeve full of guns? Like there are things where it's like, if you actually scrutinize the logic for stuff, it doesn't...
Well, it's got to be living flesh. You can't just like kill a pig and then hollow it out and stick a bunch of guns in it.
And if we were to accept that as a scientific fact, you could still, like the Terminator, grow a little meat sleeve for your guns. Like
the humans don't have the technology to grow a meat sleeve.
But the robots do. The robots could send back a plasma rifle.
Oh, sure. The robots totally could.
Yeah, Skynet could do that. It could make a meat gun. It could just be like, hey, I have the entire history of Cronenberg movies, so I can send back meat guns. Like, I'm fine with that.
If I wanted to rationalize, I would just say like they don't need it because it's he's an unstoppable robot. Like he doesn't need a lot of accessories to do the job effectively.
Well, this is another example of how James Cameron wasn't thinking about franchises yet, because he wasn't thinking about all the toys he could sell with the various future weapons. Maybe another
also
reason...
The future weapons in this movie look incredibly stupid.
They're hilariously bad. It was like they were using guns on set, and they're like, oh, wait a minute, this doesn't look future-y enough. Let's change the sound effects and put some purple blobs on top of everything.
I'm going to tape a juice box to the back of my scope and then just paint it black, and it'll be fine.
Ah, well, you see a juice box and you want to paint it black. No color anymore.
I have a question. Is there a post-credits scenes in this movie that I skipped?
No, why?
Because I'm looking through the photos on IMDb, and then there's this photo of the exterior of a building that says Cyberdyne Systems on it, and then the next photo is like two sciencey guys talking in a in that machine room, and one of them is holding the computer chip that comes back into play in T2. So either those scenes just got cut out of the movie, or I just didn't watch long enough. Photos 56 and 57 out of 106 on IMDb.
Well, I'm not going to look at that right now because we are talking about very important things, and I have
I'll send you the image address.
It's fine. I don't think it was as influential on the. I mean, I don't think it was. I don't think
but
it was
like
here.
The idea that they didn't address the idea that like somebody could find the bits that she left in the thing.
Yeah,
and that could be the bad stuff or whatever, but
perhaps they wanted to end on a more hopeful note, and so they just cut that because they wanted to just have her driving off into the, you know, the storm,
driving off into the awkward matte painting.
Da 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 da.
That theme's okay, and then sort of Arnold's drummy theme or whatever that comes back.
Dun dun dun.
That one's good, and it gets way better in the second one.
Yeah, I will say this. Like we said earlier, Brad Fidel, it's like he threw a bunch of cats on top of a Casio keyboard factory. It is bad. It is incredibly bad and distracting. Mm-hmm. Well, most of the action music in this is really just like leaning on various random keys to create some sort of atonal, painful mess. And the sounds that are elicited upon those key presses are bad. They are not good sounds. So you don't get something that... I don't demand orchestral movie scores constantly, but...
Well, you know, something 80s and something futuristic. But yeah, this one...
This one just totally misses for me.
Yeah, it does not help. In fact, it actually makes it harder to watch.
Yeah, you're making it worse. Brad, you're making it worse.
Brad, you're making it worse. Stop.
Yeah.
Speaking of... that's the other guy's Brad. did you see the Cobra's Night Slasher is in the scene there with and, Paxton?
Yeah, Bill Paxton and I always forget his name. Brian Thompson.
Brian Thompson. Yeah.
Yeah, but he's skinnier than he is later in his career.
He's still got that face though.
Yeah, he has a Brian Thompson face. And so he's instantly
he saw Arnold in this movie, and he's like, I want to look like that, except not really.
Yeah. It is, again, acting, not great. But, you know, it is Brian Thompson and Bill Paxton, so, you know, I guess.
And a third guy. There's a third guy there.
Yeah, there is a third guy. The one who actually gives him this close. But that's your lesson. Don't be Brian Thompson or Bill Paxton in a movie. You want to be the other guy who gets naked.
Be the third guy. And then also,
be the naked guy you want to see at Griffith Observatory.
Title. her roommate's boyfriend is Slider from Top Gun.
Yeah, let's talk about that problematic boyfriend, shall we?
He's a little aggressive. He
he's very aggressive.
He has a lot of specific things on his mind.
Uh-huh. Underwear and mouths and
he's very graphic and descriptive.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps he's a writer.
Perhaps he was written by a writer. And the one thing that I really object to is the way that the women have to play off his disgusting creepness.
It's very 13-year-old kind of like, oh, teehee, isn't it funny what he's saying to me on the phone, instead of like, ew, gross, can you not?
Yeah, like... Sarah Connor, when she answers the phone and gets the whole spiel, she has to, Linda Hamilton has to act like, oh, Matt, oh, gee, you know, and it's just like, it's not realistic.
It's like she's like 10 and listening in on her older sister talking to her boyfriend on the same line of the phone.
Yeah, I don't buy it. And again, I would chalk this one up to old Jimmy's writing. I think that he was he's perhaps better when he's writing women as like warrior heroes than he is about writing women as like women who react to normal everyday things, because this is unrealistic. And also later when the boyfriend comes over and they're trying to do the sex scene with the headphones, and it's just like, what the... what?
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like the whole Matt thing is just a complete swing and a miss. I don't understand the motivation for having him in here at all, other than he is a distraction for Ginger, and also a reason for Sarah to leave so that Ginger can have her private time. Matt. He's just gross, but he's not in much of the film, so that's, I guess, a blessing.
He's got some stripy underwear.
Sure. Well, it was the style at the time.
Just been thrown against a couple of walls in his underwear.
Yeah. One thing I thought was weird about that is Arnold Schwarzenegger's Terminator is just mercilessly slaughtering them before getting any confirmation at all that it is Sarah Connor. And so if he had not been there when Sarah Connor had called and left the message on the answering machine, he would have just been like, yep, Sarah Connor crossed off the list. Because
I assume he would have done a little bit more recon after he shot Ginger. He kind of like, flipped her over and was like looking at her a little bit. Like, he probably would have wandered around and like tried to find some driver's licenses or something.
Yeah, I mean, he had no... unlike Kyle Reese, he didn't have access to a photo of what Sarah Connor looked like. So he was just murdering all of the Sarah Connors. But it wasn't until after he heard the answering machine message that he went through the drawers to actually double check that it was actually the Sarah Connor who lived there that he had killed, which I feel like he had plenty of opportunity to just make sure by asking Ginger if she was Sarah Connor, like she did the first, like he did for the first victim who opened the door,
rather than going through the window in this one.
Yeah, I mean, going through the window is something you do for dramatic effect, but it is not tactically plausible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the strength/unstoppability of Arnold's Terminator in this movie? Because I think it certainly changes throughout the different movies.
I think it's fine. The thing that bothers me is the way that other characters react to his strength, notably the
cop.
Well, the cop and the guy at the Technoir Club who tries, the bouncer who tries to stop
the hand.
Him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it's just like
he falls out of frame and then he's just gone.
Yeah, he's like barely touches his hand and he's like, "Oh God, I'm destroyed." It's like, okay, it was weird. It seems implausible that he has somehow murdered him by crushing his hand. But perhaps he went into shock.
I prefer the cop where he like hits him with the car door and the cop is like, "Oh God." And it's like, no, he clearly didn't hit you very hard. And then he like throws him.
Yeah, I chalk those up to issues of execution and not necessarily issues of like inconsistent strength or something like that. I would like buy all of the things that he is doing, sort of, just if they had been filmed differently than they are. I feel like it's just how it was filmed that was just kind of like,
yeah. Ugh. And there was I don't know which one of these pages I was looking at. I think it was Wikipedia, where Cameron was saying like, "Oh, look how flawed my story is. Like, it shouldn't have worked to cast Arnold Schwarzenegger because he's supposed to be an infiltration model who blends in with human beings but will kill them or something, but he's gigantic, like he doesn't blend in at all." But like the more interesting idea to me is something that like blends in, you know, like passes 90% muster with most people, but is just like literally unstoppable. Like there's basically nothing you can do. Like he'll just like, if you slam a door in his face, he'll just walk through it because he's a giant metal machine, or he'll just smash things. Like the idea of like a fist fight with him lasting more than like 0.5 seconds, where he just like grabs you by the neck and crushes your spine. That's like the kind of Terminator in my mind that would be like terrifying. Because like, what are you going to do? You literally like run away, or you like, I don't know, you find a house to drop on him or something.
Yeah. Oh, another thing that they don't feature here is speed. He's sort of like an incredibly strong zombie. He doesn't have seemingly the ability to chase down someone. Everyone is always like running from him frantically, but then he's always just like just behind them but stalking at a stalking pace.
Well, he does run at one point, doesn't he?
Kind of, but I mean most of the time he's just kind of like walking. Like,
oh, in the beginning there when they escape out the back of the Noir Club, he kind of runs and then dives onto the car. Yeah, there is like one POV shot through his like red vision, which definitely is not helping him in that dark alleyway. But he's actually running. It's like, oh, this is interesting to see a robot pretend to run.
Mm-hmm. Just like us.
Just like us. And then when I like when they escape out of the police station, and he's like, "Ah, the car went that way. I'm going to walk around the far side of the building so the cameras can cut, rather than getting in this car and driving away because we're not set up for that stunt."
Yes, what I find funny about that is letting the camera linger on him jumping over the railing and then slowly walking around the side of the building, because there's absolutely no reason to see that. Like, you could literally have just cut when he walks out the back of the door and they've escaped. That could have been the end of the scene. I don't know why that's there at all. You should remove it.
He's the Energizer robot. He just keeps going and going, even if it's just to like slowly walk after a car.
Yeah, that tiny metal post won't stop him. He'll jump over that.
He's going to do a little bit of parkour, you know, mm-hmm. stretch his muscles a little bit.
It wasn't even parkour. He just, like, puts one leg up on it and just, like, whoop, oh, I'm over.
He was probably
cleared
just like,
the hurdle.
Look how limber I am.
Yes. Look how limber I am in this tight leather jacket and jeans.
Mm. And that's the, I guess the other thing with the strength is, like, the whole, you know, it's the classic line or whatever from the movie, I'll be back. But, like, if he was an unstoppable robot, he would just, like, grab the handle of that, like, wooden glass door and just twist it until it snaps and then just walk through. Like, why is he... Why is there any sort of artifice that he's like, oh, I'm Sarah Connor's friend? Like, no, just reach through the glass, grab that guy by his neck and kill him, and then just walk through the door and smash it.
Well, because it's a movie. So you need the spectacle of somebody driving a car into a police station to murder exactly one person.
Yeah. I like this idea of, like, the Superman who can't, like, fly kind of stuff. It's just, like, super strong, and what are you going to do?
Yeah, I mean, I don't take any issue with the idea of having a super strong robot that looks like a human, a cyborg, if you will, who is a murder robot and going after a specific target and how unstoppable he is. I feel like that is the strength of this film, that the unstoppability of it, the inevitability of it, makes him almost like a force because he can't, as Kyle Reese says, he can't be like reasoned with, he can't be bargained with. Like you're just screwed. Like you have to stop him or just run forever. And that anyone you know or care about, can be used against you because you can
yeah,
kill
also
them.
Stop calling your family and being like, well, I'm not supposed to say, but for you.
Yeah. Well, that was really dumb. But, I mean, it was smart on the Terminator's part, but it was really dumb on Sarah's part.
Yeah. Sarah, don't do that.
No, don't, Sarah.
These are desperate times.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you'd tell your mother, wouldn't you? Although Kyle Reese probably said something like he can completely disguise his voice to sound like your mother. But
I don't know. Maybe they haven't gotten to that demonstration in the future time, because how often are Terminators using the phone in a dystopian future where people are just like, well, I guess they have radios or whatever. They've got those little phone operator things from the 80s stuck in their ears.
Yeah. And another thing is, if you know that dogs can detect Terminators, assuming it's like electromagnetic field or something, then
they're just really good judges of character, like kids.
Yeah. So why hasn't he procured himself some sort of dog, like, immediately?
He should have had the scene like Arnold at the gun shop, but he goes into like a pet shop. He's like, I need a golden retriever. I need a Boston Terrier. I need a French bulldog.
No, he goes into an adoption agency and he gets whatever they have there, and it's a Chihuahua. And so he takes this tiny little Chihuahua out and uses the Chihuahua to stop Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, although by the time it gets within, you know, leash distance of the dog, it's probably end of the line for you.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is the end of the line. It's the end of the leash.
It's the end of the leash.
Yes.
Sayonara.
He'll bark back.
Hang on, I gotta type these in. It's the end of the leash. And
no. But, I mean... Back. I do like this film. Like I slagged on it for a bit about the cheapness and the rushed independent B movie feeling of it, but like I don't know, it's better than a lot of other things I can think of to watch from the '80s. The fact that we're still talking about this film now at this point is probably a good sign.
Mm. I think conceptually it's a really cool idea. I mean it's not 100% unique, but you know the 80s-ness of it, the characters involved that you come to like and appreciate, especially after the second one, are just they're with you so much that you can't help wanting to play in this sandbox more and more, which is I think the problem with this movie. It's so much fun and so interesting to try and play within this world and these rules and these characters that they keep revisiting it, thinking they're going to do something even cooler. And they just keep making bigger and bigger abominations.
Yeah, I think the problem for this is that they keep giving it to people who are fans of the franchise.
I'm a franchise. Fan of French fries too. It is a franchise. You've coined a new term. It's a franchise. It's a franchise that you can't help but be a fan of, and then everyone who makes a movie of it is going to ruin it.
No, well, that's, but see, the fans are making the movies, and so they're making their own. They're making the kinds of things that you used to find on the internet when somebody could just self-publish their little story about Kirk and Spock or whatever. And like, this is,
it's like the stories you tell when you're like hang out with your friends and get high on a Friday night. And you're like, how cool would it be if Arnold Schwarzenegger showed up back in time to fight young Arnold Schwarzenegger? Like, he did a second time loop, but he knew he would be at Griffith Observatory. So he fought himself. He was waiting.
Yeah, exactly. That is exactly the problem with the as this series progresses, and James Cameron is not involved. You get people who have witnessed James Cameron's work and want to pay homage to that, and specifically the things that they like about it by playing in the sandbox, and they're not making a new sandbox or expanding the sandbox. They're just like, I want to occupy this same space and tell a story. That perfectly...
I want to stand shoulder to shoulder with James Cameron and be like, look at us, guys. We did this together.
Yeah, remember Terminator Salvation?
Yes, that was the fourth one.
Yeah, that was Christian Bale and what's-his-face. And
Sam Worthington?
Yes, exactly. Like I said, Sam what's-his-face. It's somebody who just wanted to do a thing that's in the same stuff, and they were a fan of the thing, and it just doesn't work. And
although, to be honest, I kind of think that was that's the least of the bad sequels.
That may very well be the case, but what I'm saying is there are fans who are making these things, and they are just not able to pull it off because they can't seem to separate their appreciation of it and their ideas that they had when they were younger, perhaps, with what actually should be on the screen, because they're just, I don't know, seem infatuated with the idea of the fan fiction that they had of the what ifs and whatever. I mean, because you look at like franchises like Alien versus Predator, and there was even a comic book series. That was Alien versus Predator versus Terminator, and then I think Batman was in there at some point. I don't remember.
No, I'm
serious. These things exist out in the world because for some reason nerds are like, oh, you know what? Stan Winston worked on these, and James Cameron worked on a couple of these. That means they're all in the same universe. We saw that one skull at the end of Predator 2. Everything's the same now, and it's just it's one of those things where it's just like you guys. I know it's an idea you had, and you had a lot of fun with that idea, and that you want to share it with other people who think it's a cool idea too. But it does not need to go on up to the level of being official like stuff at that point. Like much as I gather was the case with Terminator Genesis, which I have not seen. Only I've seen some clips of it. I am not in a total media blackout for that one. That's for sure.
I think I blacked out. Drunk watching it because it was very bad.
Yeah.
I don't know why I didn't black out. I did get very drunk watching that movie.
Oh, I mean, the clips I've seen of it, I would believe it.
Somebody was like, I love Terminator and I love time paradoxes and loops. And also, have you heard of nanobots? And then they're just like,
No. I mean, but it's our own society that, like, we give people these toys to play with when they're kids and they grow up and then they ruin those toys. Like that's all they know how to do. They don't know how to make new toys. They just know how to ruin the old toys.
Like our logo is a ripoff of a Canon Films logo. Like we would be terrible. Like nobody should ever give us a
Dan.
What?
Dan.
Yes.
Nobody's ever going to give us any money to
I'm
do
just
a
saying,
movie.
Like, people like us should not be in charge of movies like this because we have such like odd reverence for the 80s that we would just put a bunch of 80s tropes in it and they'd be like, look at the 80s things we did. And everyone would be like, what about making a movie that's good?
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the really distracting things about, like, let's say Rian Johnson's a little Star Wars picture. It's like, here, look at my reference to Wings. It's like, okay, why is that in your movie? Like,
Wait,
what is the... Rian Johnson put it in a camera shot that is a reference to the movie Wings when they go to the casino planet, and there is that really, 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 really long dolly shot of them pushing into the the scene over the tables.
I thought you were talking about the TV show with Tony Shalhoub.
No.
I was like, wait a minute.
No, this is not.
Was Lowell in there somewhere?
Yeah, all of a sudden they're on Nantucket. But
Lowell comes out after he's working on one of the X-Wings, like, hey guys, this is broken.
Yeah, he's too busy with divorce these days.
I like that show.
Yeah. Not a fan, but Jason loves it, and he was really excited that it came back for another season. He's like, when can we watch it? And I'm like, I don't know, maybe later. But
second season's funny.
Okay, sure, if you say so. I know. It's just fans like things, and that's fine. That's good. I like that fans like things. I'm a fan of things. Like, if you gave me...
A Star Trek movie?
Yeah, exactly. That was exactly what I was going to say. If you gave me Star Trek to do... I would make something that would be so particular to my interests in Star Trek that it would probably perform financially terribly at the box office and just be completely baffling to most people because it would be so full of inscrutable things that only I care about. That's what happens when you are so close to that source material. And James Cameron is not that close to the source material in these films because it's something that he made to do once, and he's not operating off of a prior Terminator franchise that he's doing. So it's a whole different animal. Now, of course, though, he is his own franchise because he is avataring himself, which is, I don't know, he's going to go blind. it's just... I don't know. The world is not ready for that much self words that I probably shouldn't say. Anyway, so I don't think we really need to witness these things. You know, that's all I'm saying. It's like fans should be fans, and sometimes you should look at the work that things came from and just be like, yeah, that's what it is. Okay, moving on. And in the case of Terminator, you should look at it and be like, yeah, okay, that's what it is. Moving on. And while James Cameron was able to build off of this to make Terminator 2, and Terminator 2 outshines this movie and is far superior, it is not something that literally anyone else has been able to do since then. So I don't think it was an easy feat, and I don't think that it is necessarily something that everyone should strive towards doing. Does that make any sense? Did I ramble too much? Did I rant too much about like people who like things? People who shouldn't like things is what I'm saying. It's like, that's the core of my argument. Try not to like anything, Dan. Is that possible?
Well, sure. Okay. But, I mean...
can you possibly muster up some dislike for things?
Yeah, I think... Well, yes, I think I could do that. Plus, I definitely think the things that I like will never be offered to me. So I think that's okay there. Wait, one last closing line of question, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
As I was Googling things, trying to do additional research while we're talking here, I came across an article that, let's see, how long ago was this? Just September last year, that says Linda Hamilton, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and James Cameron are coming back for another installment in the series that will pick up after Terminator 2 and cover up all that bad stuff that we didn't like.
Yes, and... The thing about that is that James Cameron is not directing that one. Tim Miller is.
Mm.
Remember Tim Miller?
Yeah, the Deadpool guy. I see that here now.
Yes, yes. James Cameron is just producing. Although I'm sure he will have lots of helpful things to say on set.
You think he'd actually show up? I feel like he's the kind of guy that they would like wheel in a TV screen that has his face on it, and it would just be there all the time, and he could just like shout when he felt like it.
It's possible. All you really need for him to observe would be a James Cameron. But if you don't want his thoughts or feedback, you could just turn the James camera off.
I'm gonna turn this podcast camera off.
Uh-huh.